signature, you could say. In the coming months, we do another lecture every month. Anna Teixeira Pinto is going to be doing the next one, but I always massacre your second name. So I apologize in advance. I mean, that's going to be my homework for the next month, is to master this pronunciation. And Michael Birchall will be also joining us in July. But yeah, tonight I'm very happy to have Kis Mushtakamai here, whose work I have been following quite a bit, your critical work in Texas cocoons and the kind of steady flow of critiques in Art Agenda. She's a junior professor at the CX Center for Interdisciplinary Studies at the Academy of Fine Arts in München, and her PhD thesis text called Entkunstung, Artistic Models for the End of Art, is going to be coming out this summer with three books, so hopefully look forward to that. And another former guest of ours, Marina Wischmidt, is a co-author with Kirsten on a book called A Autonomy, and that is coming out also this summer. Crossing fingers, or
no,
that's definite. Okay. So, and besides that, she's been a fellow at the Young and Ike Academy and produced other volumes, Painting the Implicit Horizon, in 2012, and Realisms on Contemporary Art. So I'm very happy to have you here, and welcome, and I'm very provoked by the title, and by the last question, is it time to call upon symbolism to seize the ontology of realism. It already kind of perked my attention and had a lot of immediate knee-jerk reactions, so I'm going to try to hold back and see what's coming. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the invitation. I really like to do it because I really like the film. I've only seen Nina speak here because it's always been a lot of time. Maybe next month, and I really like the format, and so, I mean, this is also why I chose this rather weird proposal to speak about symbolism against realism. And what I initially wanted to do is start from the present tense, so start with discussing what I think, or what for me is problematic in the stakes of speculative realism, and then project back onto the politics of realism and symbolism in relation to that. But as I realized that this means that you don't introduce either of them, I turned the thing around and started from speaking about realism and symbolism, and so I end up hinting towards speculative realism, but stopping there. I mean, the other reason is that I was sick over the weekend and I'm just crap with timing, so... So I'll just start, and I'm very happy about questions. I'm very happy to discuss this because, I mean, this is also why I really like the format, because this is not so much a scientific paper as like an attempt to like rather smoothly go through what's at stake for me politically in relation to realism as a historical movement in art and symbolism as a historical movement in art. And what's the discussion of like its actualizations, or how can it be employed as a contemporary understanding of politics? So this will be a relatively open format, a programmatic sketch, if you will, because even though I was, as I just said, planning of speaking of the present tense as a contested figure of both realism and symbolism, I in the end decided to rather do something else, which is discussing why I'm interested in such a setup in the first place. So why looking at historicized movements in art to discuss contemporaneity? And why employ artistic stances to engage with philosophy? So firstly, I want to discuss what methodological approach towards art history I'm trying to pursue here, to demonstrate how canonized historically identified styles might return as present-day states beyond the field of art. And secondly, I want to briefly parallel the structural problems of art as a contemporary field of production. No, I didn't get to that one. I wanted to do that. With philosophy as a contemporary field of production. To explicate why I would argue that philosophy's intimate relationship with the aesthetic today leads not least to its being assailable within its terms. To do this, I want to use three historical models: the modern, the postmodern, and the contemporary. So the modern, obviously, as the frame of realism's rise, the postmodern as the resurgence of symbolism, and the contemporary as a field in which both epochs collide, or in which they both have become stances rather than epochs, because they represent affiliations to a past tense, affiliations which are determined to propose the present tense within their terms. So, why modern? I myself have been arguing in favor of realism as an artistic stance, as Patricia just mentioned, like in, for example, when I worked at the Anton Eyck, for quite some years, because I would always have argued that dynamic tendentiousness is one of the first premises of any artistic production, which does not resort to the stabilization offered by more representational approaches to art. So the question rises within modern art itself. It rises with the question of autonomy, and thus with the question of art's function in society, with the question of art's use value, so to say. And I'll return to the question of use value in a minute. As the Marxist art historian Klaus Herring has argued already in the 70s, looking at Gustav Courbet's work, realism implied a form of productivism. In contrast to naturalism, realism in the visual arts did not content itself with the reproduction of the factual. Realism is not a form of impressionism, as naturalism is, but it's a form of symbolism, and in a way they just play on different registers, so to say, and I'll come back to that too. So realism programmatically strove for the realization of reality, assuming that it had not realized itself yet. So looking at the history of modern art, realism is thus not, and has never been, an avant-gardism, but a modernism in the strictest possible sense. Production is its idiom, and art functions as an alternative to industrialization. Expelled from its divisions of labor, deemed unproductive for the reproduction of society at large, realism offers an alternative use value, a projective production that exceeds its present tense. And I have, I mean, like with both, I have a brief example. This is obviously symbolism. So I'll come back to that.
I thought it very realistic.
So, yeah. Yeah, that's the contemporary. So that's obviously Gustav Courbet's Stonebreakers from 1950. Which is 1.65 meters by 2.57 meters, so it's rather large. It's rather broad. And as a comparison to this, I had ordered those pictures, but it didn't really turn out the way I wanted to. This is in really wrong colors, which you can't see anyway. Jean-François Millet's The Gleaners from 1857. Which is much smaller. It's 84 centimeters by 110 centimeters. And just to show you, because most of you will have an idea of like an image in the head when you speak of naturalism and when you speak of realism. But the thing is, if you look at bourgeois art history, those things are dealt with in very close proximity. And if you look at Millet as like an example of naturalism. But if you look, for example, into conservative art history, you will also find him filed under realism, because they just don't distinguish naturalism and realism to start with. If you look at Millet on the one hand, and if you look at the way the color is used, which you can't really
see the layout.
Maybe, yeah. Sorry. It's a bit different. So if you look at the way light is used in this and color is used in this, it's very much related to Renaissance painting. What colors are used here, what they are attributing, the way in which the female figures are brought in parallel structures to the floor and to nature, so they are aligned within the landscape. This is like the hierarchy is certainly clear. The figures are part of the landscape, and they are made part of the landscape. At the same time, as female figures, they are wearing the colors which normally sacred figures would wear. So you have like the blue and the red, so you have like those, and the white, so you have like all the colors which map them as like a sort of trinity. But they are like nature is the how do you say it? Nature is what defines their stance. And if you then look at the stone cutters, which is 5 years earlier, by Gustave Courbet, and which is much, much bigger, there is the banal historical fact that the size of those paintings is really important for what those paintings represented at the time, because subjects like that weren't painted in formats of history painting. So they weren't painted in formats which had like the epic size of this painting. So this on the one hand, and on the other hand, if you look at this, this is not an aerial view. So there is not like a broad landscape within which figures are placed, but it's the other way around. You're closing in on the people. Like you're closing in on those two figures, which at the same time are very detailed. I mean, if you look at the trousers, and if you look at the hands, and if you look at... So labor is what defines the whole painting. It's again, I mean, like in the Millet, this is not about the individual which is shown, this is not about showing a specific subjectivity, but it's about showing a specific structure of subjectivity. And this is, where in the other painting, nature is the riding force of the structure of the painting, here labor is. Because it's not the human, it's the human defined by this activity, because they are in impossible poses. So those are not poses which you can hold for really long. Those are not, and at the same time, they are poses which are very physical, in contrast to the one, for example, in the Millet painting. Just to, I mean, not to give like a full argumentation around it, but just like to sketch very briefly what I mean with this distinction of naturalism and realism, and which people like Harding, for example, use extensively, but also Linda Nochlin and T.J. Clarke in his earlier writings. So if you look at this, and this is what's interesting, for example, about people like Klaus Harding argues that what is interesting in Courbet, or what makes Courbet a revolutionary painter, is the changeability which he demonstrates in his works. Not that he doesn't portray change. He doesn't show that the world changes, but he shows that the world can change. So this is the idea of like an openness of action. Like the limitation which he shows like in his paintings is at the same time in being this minuscule point of concentration, something totally different than in Millet, which is the naturalism, also because it naturalizes what it paints. It's not only because it's an impressionism, because it is not an impressionism in the closest sense, but it's a naturalism because it naturalizes the relationship of the people and nature, of the women and nature, or here of the women as part of nature. So this is a distinction which I find for you. So and already here it becomes quite obvious that my relationship to art history as a field, and it's important to stress as a modern field, I mean art history in itself is a modern field, is a contested one. So because all the aforementioned realism, naturalism, impressionism, symbolism, and in the last years even productivism, have been framed as recognizable styles, as signatures and representations of an epoch, and their political valences are measured only within art, within their artistic achievements, their progressions of autonomy. So artistic avant-gardisms, even if they are so fundamentally opposed as Dada and Surrealism were, become nevertheless pooled in one seemingly progressive corner of art history because they expanded artistic genres. They were concerned with the progress of art itself, while more modernist artistic stances, such as realism or productivism, are retrospectively deemed less progressive, less radical, because their radicality was not so much imminent to art. Neither realism nor productivism were promoting the progress of artistic autonomy or projecting its autonomy into society at large. So where realism is discussed as a style, art itself is naturalized. The same is true for the history of what is now called the historical avant-garde. Their appreciation as progressive is deduced from the formal achievements they were credited for retrospectively. So while at the time the finding of a new form for a new subject was not a formalism at all, but a necessity, a destabilization of their field of practice, it's now a heroic expansion. And I mean, in the case of Dada, Jenny Nachtigall is working on this in relation to psychoanalysis and criticizing that relationship. So in coining styles and delineating lineages of progress, art history fundamentally enacts a retrospective naturalization of art as a modern achievement. So art history itself is a fundamentally modern task, and to conversely ask for a realization of art not least means that one tries to reopen art history to bring moments of realization in relation to one another, and such moments of realization change radically with the realisms of society. So Courbet's realization was one of a use value art could have encountered revolutionary times, and an ongoing attempt to redefine this use value in relation to the very changing politics of France in the second half of the 19th century. But you can then no longer value them as formal achievements of artistic autonomy. Because, for example, I mean, if you look at, I mean, Courbet is always the easiest of all and the most popular of all examples, because this was painted in 1850. And he started like to call himself realist in the 40s and ended like in 55 with the what's it called, the artist studio, the large painting, which is interesting because it's realist and symbolist at the same time, but I don't have time to go into that. But it's very interesting because he started to be a realist after the 1948 revolution failed because it was a bourgeois revolution. So the moment he went into realism in art, or he proclaimed himself a realist in art, was the moment in which he saw the political revolution no longer at stake because it had failed through its being at the core, like Marx. I mean, Courbet's critique of it and Marx's critique of it is fairly identical. That it was a bourgeois revolution and it didn't really revolutionize society. But then when in 1971, Courbet was part of the Commune, so of the justified and rightful revolution that didn't last very long, as they tend to do. And when he was a minister in the Commune, he stopped painting. He didn't work as an artist any longer because society had realized itself. There was no need for realism in art because reality had exceeded artistic practices. So realism is always a misconception. It's always in a very concrete relationship to a misconception of reality. So realism at the same time is an inherently productivist structure. In contrast to its understanding of a style or a school, it is very expandable. And this is where postmodern enters the picture, and with its symbolism. So firstly, the reason why I have introduced realism as an historical moment, or in one specific historical moment, that of its modern premiere, so to say, and why I present symbolism through its affiliation through postmodernism, is that I doubt realism's current return at large. And when I come to the third and last part of this paper, which is too short, I will sketch out why that is the case, and it would be great to know that. Let's discuss this. So the first part two is symbolism. In response to Jean-François Lyotard's infamous text defining the postmodern of 1989, Philippe Lacoulabart remarked that, and I quote him, "the possibility or impossibility of resistance by art to the domination of aesthetics is bequeathed by modernity." So it's passed on from modernity. So when Lyotard characterizes the postmodern as an anamnesis of modernity, as like, so to say, a return of the repressed, or not so to say, he says it's a return of the repressed, Lacoulabat underlines that the success of this repression throughout modernity is itself a projection to start with. And if we think again of what I've just tried to sketch in relation to realism as a productivism, one can indeed argue that this decidedly modern art fundamentally aims to overcome the domination of aesthetics as that philosophical discipline which rose from and with the autonomy of art and which thereby aimed at expanding with and on its autonomy. So modernity, for good and for bad, is a very art historical instance because its aesthetic formulation preceded it in Kant's aesthetic as well as in Hegel's aesthetic and also in early Romanticism, which I'll come back to in a minute, and only returned with a vengeance after World War II, securing the balances of modern art after the fact, autonomizing it through aesthetics and rehashing it aesthetically. I mean, in Germany you could think of something like Hans Selmayr and Willy Baumeister and like all those publications which came directly after the Second World War trying to, or like the first documenta, like trying to secure that there is an aesthetic value to art and that this is like founded in modernity, in like European modernity in and of itself. But you could also argue the same for Theodor Adorno's aesthetic theory or in a worse sense, I would say, Peter Bürger's Theorie der Avantgarde. But let's bear with Lacoulabat for a moment, assuming that this fight over resistance prolongs, but failed as a modern one, failed as arch earths towards realization. Then, what is the postmodern? In a text recently, I quoted the American art historian Craig Owens, a close friend of Douglas Crimm, to whom I referred in the announcement of this evening. Crimm, who was the one who staged the now famous pictures show at New York's Artist Space in 1977, in his essay accompanying the show, in which works by Jack Goldstein, Robert Longo, Sherry Levine, and others were to be seen, concluded his argumentation saying that even though those artists were said to have cut all ties to modernism, they had in fact not. It was just symbolism they were alluding to. So before I come back to Owens, one quick look at symbolism. So we are, again, in the 19th century. And again, we look at an artistic stance which positions itself within the rising modernisms and industrializations of the time. And again, we look at what signifies in art history as a movement, like realism, complete with manifesto, proponents in different artistic fields, again, literature and visual arts, supply the most prominent proponents, but for reasons to be mentioned in a minute, symbolism in contrast to realism was expanded into numerous other fields, like theatre, music, poetry, of course, and philosophy as a synesthetic movement. Because in contrast to realism, symbolism took a decidedly anti-modern, but albeit in that retrospectively very modern stance, or if one again looks at it from the visual arts, symbolism is a solipsism in many ways. It's a life form, and thus it's endlessly expanding into numerous fields. And it was not a strand of production within modernity, it did not fight over modernity, but against it. Emerging from the romanticisms of the late 18th and 19th century, but now like being situated within industrialization and within modernization, deprived of the world it wanted to expand into, symbolism as realism can be characterized very literally by its title. Symbolism held on to symbols of a derealized and derealizing world in order to emancipate or even autonomize them from realization. One could describe symbolism as an inverted realism, like a naturalism which lost its mind. Where in early romanticism nature had been an autonomous force external to humankind, it became a tool to modernity. Symbolism draws a decaying nature. So where early romanticism, like in Schlegel or Novalis, for example, where in this early romanticism of like the late 18th century, sees sense arising only from the mutual reflection of humankind and nature, Symbolism perceives this nature as a sinister, insurmountably hostile court. Symbolism is the art of a class. Of that class of wealthy aristocrats and noblemen who had lost their function within modern society. And as Georges Dubry has argued, where culture as the reassurance of one's identity is in turmoil, the crisis never ceases to prolong. Autonomy here is heteronomy. It is a world in which nature itself becomes obscure, and famously in symbolism, in which gender boundaries crack and shift. The body becomes insurmountable. Femininity here exists as the only living gender because of its naturalization in romanticism. So the femme fatale, the deadly or dead woman, and we return to the Antigone, which we have to look at the beginning. The dead woman, the witch, the female priest, and so forth, all become ciphers for the biggest fear, the loss of civilization, which modernity is perceived as. And don't get me wrong, there are lots of readings of symbolism as a women-hating extravagance or something. And I would absolutely not subscribe to that because, as I just mentioned, in many ways, female gender is the only gender in symbolism. Male gender is not really thinkable within symbolism, because the virility of masculinity within modernism is something which symbolism is in and of itself totally opposed to. So the only thing it can hold on to is the totally cracked and vicious idea of a feminine form of gender that can defy modernism. And not that that's not a sick idea. But not that modernism wasn't a sick idea to start with. So in a way, what I want to argue for, I mean, I don't want to argue for realism as a heroism, which also is a problem, like with lots of art historical discussions of realism, I mean, also in Brecht and in Lukács, but predominantly in Kobe, it's discussed as a heroism. It's like, he got it all right. He just did all the perfect things. And it's not about that. I mean, A, he didn't, and B, that's not the question. But the question is really, what is at stake with reality? So realism is a form of artistic productivism which tries to expand art, which tries to crack aesthetics, which tries to go up against aesthetics and replace aesthetics with artistic production. And symbolism is just the inversion. Symbolism is, in a way, calling upon aesthetics against reality. So it's turning the same question into a completely opposite direction. And with that, I mean, the reason why I chose Sigantini is exactly that. I mean, this is a really, if somebody had been in Zurich, like it's in Zurich in the Kunsthaus, I think, it's very small, it's like this, because I always thought it was super big, because I think it looks like this. So it's called The Bad Mothers. It's from 1894. And you can't see it, but there's a child on the tip there. And it's like there's a couple of those paintings. And those in the back, those are more bad mothers. There's lots to say about Sigantini and Sigantini's like decidedly cinematic formats in painting. Like he has a very cinematic idea of what painting functions like, and he had close ties to the anarchist, not really to the anarchist movement, but to anarchism in the region where he lived in Italy, and often used the photos of the anarchists which were shot dead by the local police, and which was then like in the public in the local newspaper, the police crowding themselves of having shot 10 anarchists again, and he would have those photos, and he would use those photos as like the starting points of super pseudo-religious large-scale symbolist paintings. So there is a direct political relationship within those paintings, which is not really visible if you see them now, but yeah. Shortly getting back to this one. This is based on two things. On the one hand, it's based on Jean-Martin Charcot's photographies of women who were pathologized as being hysteric. So like the famous arch I mean, like what he used the focus on, like the famous arching female bodies, and this he mixes with a weird form of poetry, which was very popular within symbolism, and this is pseudo. It is not from India, but it is pseudo Indian. So there were Italian poets who were pretending to have Indian names and writing Indian poetry, which they translated back into Italian, which was a really weird mixture of language. and one of those guys called himself Pangyavali von Marium Pada, which is, yeah, doesn't even have much to do with names in India. And he wrote like a symbolist philosophy of nature. And one of them is about mothers about women who rejected to become mothers and were thus buried forever, like in like an icy nirvana, where those babies would like constantly live on them and thus resurrect them in a way. So this is a positive image. The idea is it's a positive image. Whatever idea that might be, but and there was also an opera based on the same narration with a libretto written by this guy, and so on. So there was, I mean, the reason why I know it's a weirdly fragmented history, but the reason why I try to do it in such little points is like, again, like here you have the painting, you have the photography, then there is this poet who at the same time wrote a philosophy of nature and the libretto for an opera. So the idea of symbolism, like to live in all parts of life and to have like a synesthetic worldview and not a style of art, is very important, and it's not the same as in realism. It's the same as in realism in a way that both were not emerging as styles, but style is what art history makes of them. They were not styles, but they were stances towards a form of aesthetic production, which was either in symbolism, bringing up aesthetic against the real, or in realism, bringing up the real against the aesthetic. So symbolism is the logical opposite of a workers' culture, which is what realism is associated with, in that it inscribes itself into a social significance that knows no future or present or past, but calls upon aesthetics against the world to defeat the real. So when the workers' movement constructed an understanding of sociability and solidarity from their social role within reality, richness in and of itself remained a privilege but was robbed of its social status. And this is like the decadence of symbolism. So symbolism is an aestheticism, decidedly. An aestheticism has the logical as well as historical inversion of realism. So why does Crimp align the artist's works he shows in 1977 with symbolism? Because modernism had failed again and again and again. And not only that, more importantly, art had pushed its own productivisms into a dead end. And here, I return briefly to Craig Owens, who in 1984 writes, "Yet, by the mid of the 70s, the post-studio movement appeared to have lost much of its momentum. Ephemeral and site-specific works had been effectively reinserted into the circuits of commercial distribution and exchange via photography, and artists who attempted to maneuver within institutional precincts seemed ultimately to confirm the liberal democratic myth of the elasticity of those institutions. Their ability to tolerate even their own most hostile opposition. It was at this point that a new group of artists emerged, concerned with power less as it is vested in art world institutions and more as it is diffuses through society. Significantly, and roughly at the same time, Jean Baudrillard began publishing a series of extremely trenchant critiques of productivist ideology. arguing that power is no longer exercised exclusively or even primarily through control of the means of production, but through control of the means of representation, the code. What was needed then was a critique of representation, but one free from a productivist bias, and it was such a critique that this new group of artists set out to provide. So the group of artists Owen speaks of in 1984 is the one Krim had exhibited already in 1977, and his hint towards Baudrillard leads us another important trail here. The shift from the production of use value in art, as I mapped it out for realism, to the production of exchange value. Both symbolism and the rise of postmodern art in the late 70s and early 80s do, as Owen says, in relation to the artists of his time, one page later, and I quote, not subscribe to the positive fallacy of the image. Both reject productivism, or a modern idea of progress, and both see and produce a crisis of identity and a crisis of representation. This is an art exclusively focused on exchange values, on symbolic as well as on monetary exchange values, which perpetuates the present tense through the endless repetition of its surfaces without ever affirming them. And again, gender lies at the core of this crisis. And again, it is the representations and evaluations of the female figure which emerges at the center of this anti-productivism. Only that here, the sexualized identity is no longer adhering to early modern genre types, but employs representation to negate the productivist appearances of heterosexual normality, nuclear family at the core of the state. So a realism expanded the counterproductivism to the industrialism it was expelled from, aiming from for a use value beyond capital. Symbolism and its postmodern return were propelling representations as pure exchange value that was oblivious to any use value that might have been attached to it. And this is where we enter the present tense. Art here is a replacement for religion and one of politics, because both seem too administrative with nothing to administer. The symbol, ich habe irgendwas falsch, sorry, I just fuck up my pages. Sorry. So because it is exactly this relation of use value and exchange value, the possibility to engage one in the ignorance of the other, which in Karl Marx's characterization of capital finds its first precipitation, and which in productivism and realism is turned into a pure use of use value of art, while in symbolism and postmodernism is turned towards the pure exchange value of art. The crisis of financialized capitalism, within which speculative realism rose as the promise of an ontological stabilization, consisted not least in the evasion of the distinction of use value and exchange value. As Christian Marazzi and numerous others have noted, the financialization is not a sector within capital, but much rather the fact that in the 1990s, it was exactly the producing industries, the automobile industry predominantly, which financialized itself, founded its own banks, and began to operate as banks generating revenue from financial transactions as well as from production. And it is this substantial financialization of capitalism as such which lets the distinction between use and exchange value collapse. Not because one has shifted towards the other, but because they have become interchangeable. So to propose a speculative realism within this situation as a decidedly ontological strain of philosophy which evades this obsolescence of production and reproduction in order to dedicate its perspective exclusively to the contingencies beyond correlationism might seem in and of itself a quite conservative move. And the problem is that I end here because I didn't have the time to write more about this. And that's really mean, I know, because sort of the trigger of this is to go more into. But I'm really happy to, in the discussion, like discuss more like what, why I have like this, why I think that this is important or relevant to criticize. speculative.
And what does it have to do with bad mothers?
With bad mothers? I would say it has, in not necessarily with bad mothers, but with, I would say, like today, there is again a total over-sexualization of the female figure. I mean, if you look at the Stuart Boer show, which was at Buchholz, or if you look at the John Wilson show at Zirna with this horrible robot, animatronics robot, which you can see on YouTube, if you want to, like, fuck up your ego. Or if you look at the new film by, what's his name, Jonathan Glazer, Under the Skin, with Scarlett Johansson,
mm-hmm.
Where she's an alien, and I would say, like, at the moment there are lots of hypersexualizations of female figures returning, and there is no equivalent to it. There is not the hypersexualization of the male, but it is again like a question of.
If you have this hyper-speculative realism, you know, like this idea of the great outdoors, you know, pulling yourself by the bootstraps, you know, like.
Yeah, but is that a natural? I mean, what, like, gender within that is obliterated?
Is it?
Mm. Well, it's reinstated as a form of.
Well, it's difficult to say. I think just we should all be fair, at least, and say, to use that term, they all adhere to this kind of Miyasu meta argument, mm-hmm. Then they all kind of explode from there. So I just find it difficult to speak about, like, as a singular, you know what I mean? As a kind of individuated, or as a style, you know? To put
I would
it in
say
those.
It's a style in a way. I mean, that's part of my problem with it.
Or they unravel it in different directions.
But is there any? I mean, there. I wouldn't attack. Like, for example, I would say that I find the Rizanigirastani's idea of materialism, of like a exhumation, like an exhuming materialism, very productive.
Mm-hmm.
And find it very much different, for example, say from Brian Harman's ontological blurb. But where did I miss the gender part?
I'm just saying, I think I wouldn't shut it down yet, because I've also been seeing a rise of conferences are starting to happen around this theme that are being taken up by gender studies, feminist groups.
Yeah,
so
I definitely think that feminism is taking it up because it's a very influential academic branch, commodity form.
I mean, isn't the question about gender whether being anti-correlationist is a kind of undoing of all the achievements of feminism in the past, like, 50 years? If then these men just come up and say this is reality that exists outside of your subjective experience. That it's that there is a sort of gender studies critique of it, of that group of people, if you accept their own definition as being against co-relation or that way of describing it.
Mm. That's what I think was, like, some of them are super hardcore, like you described. I think there's others that are taking it with a little bit more nuance. Like, for example, Levi Bryant, who's not one of the main players.
He says,
instead
of being anti-co-relationist, he's pan-co-relationist. Very different.
All I'm saying is that you can take the logical conclusions of this one argument, and there's still a lot of space to spin it and to take, you know, extract from it what you will. I wouldn't put it necessarily in this definitive.
But that's a little bit of a problem, no? Like, you're shifting the goalposts. Every time you say, oh, it's about this, they say, like, no, because this other one that just popped out of the blue, you know, like, and that's, you know, like,
I'm not
defending. There's always a rabbit that you can take out of a hat and say, like, you know, because.
And I don't think, I totally agree. I don't think the question is if forced to, one or two of them can come up with some kind of theory which mentions the word gender.
Mm.
But in the structure of that theory, like you said, in the structure of that theory, a progressive idea of gender is impossible. Because, I mean, in Meyasul, I mean, anyway, to, but also, I mean, in the ontologia, in the In Returning Realism, has an ontological stance, I still don't understand why it's speculative realism and not speculative naturalism, because that's what it is. And I don't see, like, apart from, again, Miguel Astani, who argues nature as a sick, oil-fested, whatever, where I think there is an interesting leap between, like, a realism and a naturalism, I don't really see an undermining of all the things which politically come with naturalism. Because in this ontologization of the other side of the human, this question is just deferred, and it's not a coincidence that it's not a feminist theory. It's just not in the material. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, speaking of.
I mean, I'm a bit wary of mapping all these abstract times under each other, but for the speculative realism, some of them are like taking to calling it speculative materialism instead. And how would you see that working out?
Mm. I would say, I mean, like I said, with Miguel Astani, I would say that makes sense. With Miguel Astani, I think it makes sense to call it a speculative materialism. But for example, if you look at, can you maybe just turn that off? Thank you. Because at the same time, I mean, if you it depends how you shift the terms. Because if you use what I would argue for with using realism and symbolism in their historical genesis, is that this genesis cannot just be cut off in the contemporary claiming of words. And the same is true for materialism. I mean, you have the problem with, like, the other side of speculative realism would be this new materialism, would be like Diana Poole and Latour and a bit more Haraway and a bit more Barrett. But that would be like the new materialism, but that relates to historical materialism and then argues why it differs from there and when. And whatever you want from it, it is a relation to that, whereas speculative realism makes a claim which is really the founding of a school. I mean, it's much more than symbolism and realism was, the founding of a trend, of saying we are giving ourselves this name, this is a school, this is a style, you can recognize us by only one thing, which is like the prevalence of the object, and in everything else we are going in different directions, or at least like always claiming this identity. But the use of the terms, like be it materialism or be it realism in this, is totally, sorry, my English has just really left me, beliebig.
Arbitrary,
yeah. It's totally arbitrary. And this is why I had, like, this is why I was saying, okay, maybe it's time to bring up symbolism against realism, because what they manage with overclaiming that word without making claim to its history at the same time is to make it unusable for any other form of reference at the moment. Like, nobody will think of even of socialist realism when you say realism. Mm-hmm. Everybody will think of, like, Graham Harman, which is... absurd, but at the same time reality. So this is why, like, I mean, if they use like a term which has such huge historical claim, and I mean really problematic ones, but such huge historical claims, how to then push this out of the center again, and how to attack this in order to regain also realism as a form of discussion, and yeah.
Yeah, but you couldn't call them post-naturalists because that would bring this idea of like musée de la chasse et de la nature, which in France is very connoted with this person.
Yeah, they would. I once said that when Graham Harman was there, he was furious.
Yeah,
he was really annoyed. But he didn't speak to me anymore.
It's clear why, no, like, because of course, like, this would bring up all these kind of conversations that are very unpleasant for them.
Yeah.
Like, amongst us.
Kerstin, I would like to hear a little bit more about the relation between this postmodern symbolism you were talking about and this new kind of realism
mm-hmm.
today. You know, because how did that now connect? Now, and is there not like some kind of symbolism still in this kind of realistic proclamations, like from speculative realism?
No, absolutely. No, absolutely. I mean, there is. I mean, the most obvious case is Mea Susburger Malami, and I would say, I mean, this is like the other part which I didn't really manage writing before I came. Like I started arguing, like within the crisis, like within the financialized crisis of capital, as use value and exchange value, it doesn't really make sense to differentiate between them as systematic categories. Or it makes sense, but only as a form of regulative idea in relation to what modern capital was, and in relation to Karl Marx's critique of capital, of course. But if you can't really distinguish them, then also if you look at artistic production, productivism and symbolism, or productivism and postmodernism, are not systematically opposed, but are happening at the same time. So the symbol, so the symbolism is at the same time a productivism, and the other way around. So I would say, and I think, like, or I found, like, in relation to, I find in relation to that, like the ontologization of speculative realism is sort of a cheap escape in this. Because you escape exactly this Uneindeutigkeit, this shifting moment of you can't really go on the side of realism any longer, or on the side of its contrary, of the exchange value. But you have to always think both in relation to one another. And I mean, if you look at the artistic productions, or if you look at the art which has been brought again and again in relation to speculative realism, which is what is then called post-internet art, or like, don't like to term it, however. Then this is mostly artistic production which exactly faces that. Which, if you look at Ryan Tricartin, no matter how much he yells at you when you look at the videos, it is very much a symbolism and a realism at the very same time, because structurally it is a reconstruction of gender terms, which is totally on the height of the present tense, which is totally on eye level with the present tense, and which is not renaturalizing the present tense. I mean, which you have as a political move within crisis on so many levels, like a renaturalization of the nuclear family, of what is a man, what is a woman, like all this crap, which keeps shooting up in crisis as, like, let's look back to the 50s. And Tricartin, and that, I think, is very interesting because it is another form of materiality which he proposes, which is one which is digital not on its surfaces, but in its very core, in each and every structure of bodily or technological fibre. And at the same time, the social models he proposes are the ones which are oriented on the disintegration of the present tense, but forming a form of productivism of this disintegration. And I don't mean to, like, you could play this through with like quite a few of those people. And it always becomes, and this is what I find, and this I find interesting in relation to speculative realism, because again, if you look at Miguel Nostrani, there are like possibilities, or there are like productive structures of materiality which you can use to think about this, which is not really happening in, or like, as far as I'm concerned with it. which is not really which is not really the case in Meyer Sweep. I mean, in Ray Brusky, I find you also have like some of those moments, but this is mostly because he implies in his idea a form of like spontaneity and immediacy, which can re-embark on materializations, like without going to correlation. So, but how? Was that a correct answer?
Could you explain a little bit why you think that the image of, or the female image is hypersexualized by Stuart Wu, you mentioned? I would really like to know how you see it.
The problem I have with it, and there is a video of him, which is online also, which is like an ego shooter. And it's distinguished in different characters, which are people in their teens, I think. And they are talking about the first time they had sex, or the first like embarrassing moment or something. And it's super gendered. It's very much like it's the female or the male, and mostly the female. And in the works I've seen of him, I mean, also the Sex and the City series. There is always the re-representation of the female figure as a figure of commodity fetishism, and this can then like over exaggerate itself, and in that like perform a form of agency in some of the works, or it can just be like the desecrated body in and of itself. But what I find problematic, but at the same time like in other works interesting, not necessarily in this, but in other works interesting, is that. To think about like what is the reason, like why is the female gender at the moment in contemporary art so prevalent and so sexualized, and what can you do with it? I mean, because on the one hand, sure, you can reject it, and attack. I mean, for example, in the Jordan Wilson animatronic. He built a robot, like for his current show at David Stirner in New York, he built a robot with an animatronics company, and it's a life-size figure, a quite tall life-size figure, of a female body in like a stripper's costume, it has like oil on the arms, like it looks sort of not in the best shape. And wears like a, how do you say, oh, I don't know how to say it. She's wearing white plastic stripper clothes and has like a long, long blonde hair, wig, and has a mask. And this mask is like dark green and has like a witch's face. And the eyes follow you when you go through the room. And I didn't mention the best thing yet, because she there's a pole, like she's dancing in relation to a pole, and that pole is not in front of her, but it runs into her, and she dances in front of the mirror, and she speaks a text, which is his text, which is, what is it, my mother's dead, my father is dead, I'm gay, I'm alone.
What happened to irony, damn it?
Yeah, irony has left the building. We're just there with like self-loathing white rich male, and there really like you can see like all the all like it's like a projection of all the objection he has for himself, or he like demonstrates as his own, projected onto a female figure. So it's not even about a woman. It's not about like a desecrated subject. It's just that the female body is the best mode of expression for this kind of desecration. And that's what I find extremely hard about it. And like worth attacking.
But you would not relate this to any tradition of symbolism then?
I wouldn't. I had just before I thought about another example, which again, like, can I wouldn't. The reason why I wouldn't relate it to symbolism is because in symbolist painting, the women are not the handpuppen, Sprachfiguren, how do you say, like the
marionettes?
They're not the marionettes, exactly. They're not the marionettes through which a male voice is talking, but they are the indecipherable form of nature which is dangerous and can't be contained. And that's different in like the aforementioned, because that can be contained, because it's just, it doesn't have a life of its own, it's just desecrated. And that's the same in the Jonathan Glazer movie, which is really, which I found really irritating, because it's, if anybody wants to see it, hasn't seen it, and doesn't want to hear how it's ending, please do this. Because Scarlett Johansson, I don't know who of you has seen it, she plays an alien, and the structure is really interesting, I find, because it's a portrait of her. It's not about the relation of alien and the human race, or alien society and human society, or like any of this pseudo-social bullshit, but it's an idea of portraying the alien. And she's very like single-minded. She's driving around, picking up guys, killing them. So there's not much talking in the whole film. And then, like, at some point she loses sight of that and stops doing that because she met one guy she didn't want to kill, but she doesn't have any personal relationship to him, she just doesn't want to kill him. And then she begins running around and running away, and the film ends with a rape scene. The film ends with her being raped and then, like, being burned by that guy who tries to rape her. And it's I mean, it's totally unnecessary. If you like, if you want to perform, if you want to show sexualized violence, you don't need to have a naturalized rape scene. I mean, it's, and this is a form of violence which in, which I find like it appears in, appears relatively often at the moment. And I couldn't think of like. We were thinking about it the other day, if we could come up with a male example, like if we could come up with like the opposite of like super sexualized male figure. I'm really happy to hear about that.
No, actually, I still don't know any male examples, but I was thinking, now as you spoke about it so much, about this over-sexualization and violence, and saying that symbolism is not exactly NSCY related, I mean, but what about all these kind of, around the 1920s, 30s, all this kind of almost genre of sort of sexual rape scenes, like Bruce Mort and so forth. And you talked about like the over-naturalization of sexual positions in relation to crisis, so I was wondering whether you thought about it in that way further, or if you see that related, because that would make sense somehow.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that would... I mean, and to this, like, if one would discuss it within those terms, which Owens picks up, I want to say, like, modernism is productivism, basically, and this productivism is like failing in different directions, and it's trying again, but it's failing, and then like with post-conceptual art of the 70s, it has over-documented itself so much that it turns into a representation. And within that, like the genre of the Lustmord in the 20s. Would in a way be like a strange, because I mean, if you look at like there is symbolist, like there is late symbolist art at the same time. I mean, if you look at early Beckmanns, which are super symbolistic, but can't really grasp a relationship to like the symbolism Beckmann grasps for is already a modern one. So it becomes deferred in time. And with the Lustmord, there is also, I mean, the neue, at the very same time, the neue Sachlichkeit tendency to SM, but to very elaborate and very self-conscious female self-representations and like male and female joint self-representations of a violent form of physical life. So I find this, like, this is it's another moment of crisis which one can look at, like, but I don't know that much about it. I just, like, know a bit about, like, the early Sachlichkeit, like, about Hubbub and those kind of people. But, no, it's definitely interesting because it's also, I mean, it's, again, like, another moment of crisis in which this turns into a very concrete constellation of the Weimar Republic society.
Yeah.
Because again, I mean, all of this, like, it's not a global phenomenon. I mean, realism is not a global phenomenon. I mean, like, all of this is very regional and changes very much, like, within its regionalism. And I mean, that's another thing which would be important to think about in relation to the present tense, of course, because what not only global capitalism has done, but even more so, what financialized crisis of global capitalism has done is, on the one hand, to have another shift of more globalization, like of more negative unification of global standards, but at the same time a new shift of regionalisms, because of the repercussions that this has. I mean, you can see it in Europe extremely prevalently, and I was discussing with Anya Kirshner about it, and who lives in Athens, and who was saying that, well, at the moment, like, horror and symbolism are like genres which lots of her friends work in, because this is what makes little sense to use as like a political form of production and art in Athens at the moment.
Yeah, I have a question. So you, in relation to film, how you would think of the gender relations in Spring Breakers, in how many Korean Spring Breakers?
I couldn't watch it. I tried to watch it. I started to watch it. And I was like, oh no, I can't. I'm sorry. I'm a failure in that.
Yeah. Because I think it might be interesting. Maybe open a departing direction, or like, I mean, on the one hand, it seems very, because it has like kind of aspects in both directions. So.
Yeah. No, that was like, I wanted to watch it and. He was saying that it was really like good in that aspect, but I couldn't. I have to try it again.
I also didn't watch it, but I had the impression that he was using the girls as some sort of like phallic ersatz. No, like the girls were like phallic projection of this guy. No, like
I wasn't put it that easily for him, but I guess that's another discussion.
You have to see it.
No, because you have a lot of this, especially in American culture, you know, like the whole woman is usually like a phallic projection, like, and then the female body parts actually are ciphers for female femininity, female.
Yeah, like in the, yeah, there's the which again like has an interesting prehistory in modernism. I mean, with the Linda Loughlin book, like the body in pieces as like the modern metaphor.
Does anyone have any other questions, comments?
So I want to excuse myself again for like turning what I was proposing to speak about around the other way and like speaking to lots of history to you.
No, I think we would like to digest after this. So thank you so much.
Thank you.